Thank you and good morning. My name is Noel Radomski. I'm the director of WISCAPE, which is stands for the Wisconsin Center for the Advancement of Post-Secondary Education. I want to welcome everyone this morning to the second Wisconsin Idea Forum. Today's topic is innovative ideas for need-based aid in Wisconsin. We have an exciting selection of speakers and panels here to discuss this issue, and we're looking forward to your questions and contributions. Wisconsin Eye is here today helping us fulfill our goal of reaching out and making sure that the resources of the university are available to the state of Wisconsin. Thank you very much for joining us. I also want to extend a special thank you and welcome to the participants who are listening online, and we hope posting questions and comments on our forum website. We look forward to hearing from you as well. Before we move into our first panel, let me introduce Senior Vice President for Academic Affairs from the UW System, Rebecca Martin, who will start off with some special remarks. Rebecca?
Thank you. And I'd like to add my good morning and welcome to you as well. The Wisconsin Idea Forum is an exciting new effort that really puts the Wisconsin idea into action and taps into the UW system's longstanding tradition of leveraging our resources to benefit the citizens of Wisconsin. As Noel mentioned, this is the second Wisconsin Idea Forum. Our first forum, held last spring at UW-Eau Claire, covered the issue of alcohol abuse. And I noticed in your packet is a write-up of that session and some of the policy ideas that came out of the work that day. The goal of the Wisconsin Idea Forum is to bring together diverse voices and stakeholders for substantive and far-reaching policy discussions. These forums will tackle some of the weighty topics now facing us in Wisconsin, from social and environmental issues to economic challenges. The forums will inform debate around these issues by bringing objective, research-based information to the discussion. These forums are part of the UW system's growth agenda, which is aimed at improving the vitality of our state. As you probably know, the growth agenda for Wisconsin is the University of Wisconsin system's vision for the future. It is a three-pronged mission to grow more college graduates, grow more jobs, and build stronger communities. And it is that third goal, building stronger communities, that led to the development of the Wisconsin Idea Forums. And this forum today on financial aid will also help us increase the number of college graduates in Wisconsin, a very important mission for the university. I would like to thank UW-Madison for serving as the host of this Wisconsin Idea Forum. We, as Noel mentioned, have also expanded the reach by making the event accessible to participations across the state. And for all of you, your willingness to join the entire state in advancing this public policy on financial aid is to be applauded. Looking ahead, our plan is to hold a Wisconsin Idea Forum twice each year. Our next forum will be hosted in the spring by UW Extension and Colleges and will focus on building sustainable communities. This is an ambitious endeavor with great potential, and we look forward to seeing the results, real results, in informing and influencing policy for our state. We are all navigating through some very challenging times, but at the UW system, we are confident that the growth agenda and efforts like the Wisconsin Idea Forums will better prepare us to meet the future from a position of strength. So I'd like to thank all of you in Madison and all of you across the state for participating today in this Wisconsin Idea Forum. I hope you look for the results of this forum, your ideas in action coming out first in Wisconsin People and Ideas, probably in the next issue, and hopefully in the future as we work with our legislator and our state government in order to try to put some of these ideas into action. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Rebecca. And I also want to say a quick special thank you to Bob Jokisch, who helped us plan this forum. So thank you, Bob. I now want to introduce a very special guest, a very honored guest, our very own Chancellor Biddy Martin, right here from UW-Madison. Chancellor Martin.
Good morning, everyone. This mic seems so far away. Good morning. How is everyone? Well, I'm delighted to welcome you to UW-Madison, and I want to thank Noel Radomski and Wiscape for organizing this Wisconsin Idea Seminar. We're delighted to have you here, and in particular for this topic, which is very close to our hearts and one of our highest priorities at UW-Madison. In my view, as many of you have heard of probably too frequently over the past year, UW-Madison and perhaps the system as a whole has waited too long to take seriously the need for need-based financial aid in the state of Wisconsin. At UW-Madison, our differential tuition and our Madison Initiative for Undergraduates is aimed at helping us build a much bigger reserve and much greater capacity in the realm of need-based financial aid. We will use increased tuition to do that, and we're in the midst of a private fundraising campaign called the Great People Scholarship Campaign, which we will use to match what we use from tuition funding. Why is financial aid so important at a place like UW-Madison? Because the cost of education at research universities, certainly, and at other institutions, has grown, and in part because universities are so labor-intensive, and because research universities and increasingly other universities are so technology-intensive, and because with research and development having moved out of industry increasingly into universities, the costs of doing the research and producing the jobs that the state so badly needs falls to research universities and to the other institutions throughout the state. For those reasons, it's very hard to keep tuition down, and in fact, in my view, it's economically unwise to try and keep tuition at the bottom of our peer group. We can't maintain the quality of our degrees, nor can we maintain what we need to do to serve the state economically by failing to compete with our peers or failing to offer the best possible education and the most highly productive research and technology transfer. What has happened in the private institutions, including the one from which I came here? They have gone and have been for quite a long time involved in what I think it's accurate to call a high tuition, high financial aid model. And for many of them, it's working quite well. At Princeton, for example, the percentage and the absolute numbers of Pell Grant recipients has gone up dramatically over a very short period of time because of the financial aid programs they now offer. The same is true at many of the other elite privates. But very few institutions can afford the amount of financial aid that Harvard, Yale, and Princeton, not to mention Stanford, can afford to offer. We're a public university, and I think it's our job to offer what I would call a moderate tuition with high financial aid. Moderate tuition meaning staying at the median, well, we're not at the median, getting to the median of our peer groups, staying competitive, ensuring the quality of education and research, while also assuring that young people from families of modest means can afford to come to UW-Madison and to the other system campuses. This is a very difficult goal to achieve over time, to remain public in our purposes and commitments and world-class as a research university. But that's what we aim to do. Figuring out what could be done at a larger level, on a larger scale about financial aid is absolutely essential to all of us. It's not just about money, although both the state government and the federal government need to do a great deal more to provide financial aid to needy students and families. They also need to change the process of applying for financial aid at the federal level. They need to simplify it considerably. And we in the state need to help ensure that students and families of modest means understand what it takes and are helped in implementing the process of applying for financial aid. It's also about imagination, not just about money and not just about process. It's about imagination. When people in the state and their children start to believe they can no longer afford higher education, then not only the state, but the country and the world is in trouble. So we've got to also make sure we're helping ensure that people from communities of modest means, people who are beginning to feel they can't afford an education at our campuses, change that view by virtue of what we can show them we can offer in the way of financial aid. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now I'd like to kick things off with our panel, our first panel of the day. As you can see, our panel is made up of six leading professionals throughout Wisconsin in the area of financial aid. In no particular order, Amy Kerwin is the Chief Guarantee Officer from the Great Lakes Higher Education Corporation. Kevin Ingram is the Director of the Wisconsin Education Opportunity Program at the Department of Public Instruction. I think I know, you know where Kevin is. Connie Hutchinson is the Executive Secretary, of the Higher Education AIDS Board. Mary Gulbranson is the Executive Director of the Fund for Wisconsin Scholars. Molly Dillman is the State Coordinator for the No to Go Wisconsin campaign. And of course, Amy Bechtum is the Director of the Office of the Wisconsin Covenant. So what we did was generated a few questions to get us started this morning. But before we go to those questions, we wanted the panelists to say a few words about themselves and their organizations rather than myself. So with that, I'm going to ask each of our panelists to introduce themselves, say a few words about the organizations they work for. After that, then, we'll turn to our two burning questions that we identified prior to today's events. These questions were developed weeks ago, and I hope they were shared with our panelists in advance of today's meeting. So each panelist will take a minute or two to answer each question, and that will take us to about 10 o'clock. So if we can just go, if you'd like, just go in order. So Connie, do you want to introduce yourself and say a few words about yourself and HEAP?
I'm Connie Hutchison. Many people don't know state agency, and we are responsible for overseeing finance at the state level. We work primarily with the financial aid offices at each of the campuses for the private and tech. But I've been at the board for 6 years. Prior to that, Jane Hoyt was here, Executive Secretary. She's so, that'd be the financial aid here in our offices. But anything that we that works out well. Advisors who are our feet on the street. Oh, I guess they had to turn it on.
You might have to start over.
That's all right, Kevin.
Good morning. My name is Kevin Ingram, and I'm working with the Department of Public Instruction with as part of the Wisconsin Education Opportunity Program, which is a division within DPI. Prior to WEOP being a part of the Department of Public Instruction, it used to be a part of the Higher Education Aids Board. And then because DPI was more suited for working with directly with high schools, we were moved over to DPI. My role right now is working with seven offices across the state: Ashland, Eau Claire, Wausau, Green Bay, Madison, Milwaukee, and Racine. And through the state efforts, and really it's because of the Higher Education Aids Board giving us TIP dollars to help reach out into the community to attract students to apply for TIP, allows us to do what we call our state talent search outreach and go around the state and encourage students to apply for college. We also have a pre-college component in the sense that we were fortunate to have a Gear Up grant, an Upper Bound grant, and a talent search grant, along with this, DPI sponsoring the DPI scholarship program for students who are eligible for free and reduced lunch to attend pre-college programs around the state to get them acclimated to wanting to go to college and understand the whole financial aid process.
Good morning. My name is Mary Gulbranson, and I work for the Fund for Wisconsin Scholars. The Fund for Wisconsin Scholars is a private, not-for-profit charitable organization that was formed 2 years ago. Actually, we're just celebrating our second birthday this month. It was founded where it had a founding gift from John and Tasha Moorgridge, and we announced that in December of 2007, and we gave our first grants last fall. These are all need-based grants, and they're provided to students who attended public high schools in Wisconsin and are attending public colleges in the state of Wisconsin. The students are selected through a set of criteria that were established by our board of directors, and then we work with the financial aid offices at each of the campuses. They submit those names to the Higher Education Aids Board, and we randomly select the students that receive the grants. So students don't apply for these grants. Right now our grants are $3,500 per year for four-year students and $1,800 per year for two-year students. And the students are eligible for up to 10 semesters. The focus of our grants is not on access to college, though we support that heartily. We're really retention grants. We want students to stay in college, and our goal is really completion of college. We've been working with all of the financial aid offices, and truthfully would not be here without the financial aid officers of the state of Wisconsin. I think we really have a gem in this state and pearls in every office that is just really remarkable. I've been in K-12 education for 29 years, and actually I'm a nurse, so you can try to figure this all out. But why I'm sitting here, and I don't consider myself a leader, I'm a learner, and it's been a very, very interesting journey, and I thank Connie very much for all of her help and support and all the financial aid officers.
Good morning. I'm Amy Beckham, Director of the Office of the Wisconsin Covenant. Wisconsin Covenant is a state education program focused on motivating students to plan early for college with hopes to increase the number of prepared students pursuing post-secondary education in the state of Wisconsin. Since it was introduced by Governor Jim Doyle in 2007, we now have more than 50,000 students in the program committed to working hard, getting good grades, taking the right courses, staying out of trouble in high school. In return to with a guaranteed place in one of our partnered educational sectors, public, private, and technical colleges. They also receive a financial aid package based on their family's federally defined financial aid. Wisconsin Covenant Scholars, students who actually complete the program, also have access to Wisconsin Covenant Scholars grants, an additional $25 million that the governor set in the budget, as well as funding from the Wisconsin Covenant Foundation, a private nonprofit that was created with an initial gift of $40 million from the Great Lakes Higher Education Corporation.
My name is Molly Delman. I'm the state coordinator for Know How to Go Wisconsin. Know How to Go has a couple of facets, the first of which is a public service campaign that is a partnership between the Lumina Foundation for Education, the American Council on Education, the Ad Council, and then in the state, there's a lot of partners, so that's a good thing. All three sectors of higher ed, Great Lakes Higher Education Corp, the Wisconsin Covenant, HEAB, there's a lot of partners that are part of the public service campaign, which the goal of which is to give the four steps to college to students starting in seventh grade up so that they're pre-prepared when it's time to start applying for college. The second facet to Know How to Go, which was just launched last week, is we received a grant from the Lumina Foundation to start the state's College Access Network. The Know How to Go Wisconsin College Access Network is a support network that encourages collaboration between pre-college initiatives throughout the state so that resources and information are being used effectively and efficiently as possible. Ultimately, the goal is to increase the number of college grads in the state through this collaborative effort and scaling program capacity. Those are the two big parts of Know How to Go Wisconsin.
Great. Thank you. You're way too efficient because you're way ahead of schedule. Which is a good thing because if we stay on schedule, that means the audience get to ask some questions after our two questions. So thank you. Let's get started with our first question. And we decided to focus a little bit looking ahead as opposed to what is today or what was yesterday. So the question is need-based financial aid reaching all those who need it in Wisconsin? So again, the question is need-based financial aid reaching all those who need it in Wisconsin? And then we have a little sub-question, if not, where are the gaps? And this question can be interpreted many different ways, and we encourage the panelists to take different directions. Sometimes when people talk about need-based financial aid and college access and completion, they focus exclusively on need-based aid. But there's, as the panel discussed this morning, as in the introductions of their organizations, need-based financial aid is very important, but so too are other components that lead to the student's preparation and ultimately access, and then we hope completion to post-secondary education in Wisconsin to both the private universities and the public universities, the two-year colleges and the four-year universities. So with that context in mind, for you, to help you think about questions when we get done with these two questions, as well as to help the panelists with their answers. So, Connie, do you mind if you go first? Because you're closest to me, and then we would go reverse order, so you'd be last next time.
Sure.
Okay.
it's great because then I don't, you know, have to say I agree with everything everybody else said.
That was my plan.
Financial aid is not reaching all of the students that it needs to reach. We currently have about close to 28,000 students in the state at the public and private colleges and universities who are eligible for the state higher education grant and the tuition grant who will not receive financial aid, will not receive those grants this year because the grants have been underfunded. And much of that has to do with the economy. Now, since Governor Doyle took office nearly 8 years ago, he has tripled financial aid in the state. However, I need to clarify that most of that tripling has gone to the UW colleges and universities. And there's a reason for that. UW doesn't have the different kinds of funding mechanisms that are afforded the private and independent colleges and the technical colleges to increase their own revenues. So there have been significant cuts to the amount of money that has gone, state money, general public revenue that's gone to the UW system schools. And in response to that, tuition has had to increase, and so a corresponding increase in financial aid has helped with that burden for some students. but not for all students. Additionally, a lot of the money that's gone into financial aid has actually come from student auxiliary funds that have been on the campuses, and that's kind of an untold story. So students who are on campuses are actually, in many cases, helping to fund financial aid for other schools. Now, just because there's rationale behind the increase in the financial aid for UW system schools doesn't mean that the other schools, the technical colleges and the private and independent colleges and universities, didn't need the money. They're terribly underfunded in financial aid. And currently at the technical colleges alone, there's over 21,000 students who will not receive aid this year. Now, there are more students in the past 2 years who've been eligible for aid, partly because of the economy. We have a lot more students applying for aid, and a lot of families who've been displaced who are ending up in our colleges and universities and trying to get their education, trying to find a new path so that they have an opportunity to find a new job, because a lot of the jobs have been eliminated. So we're not keeping pace with the need in Wisconsin. There's another thing that's happening too, and this isn't really the fault of anyone, but one of the things that I see from my position is that it's becoming more and more difficult in the financial aid offices, because the complexity of the programs at the federal level and at the state level they're becoming more complex. The rules and regulations are changing all the time. They're having to relearn things in the financial aid office as they're facing cutbacks in staff and furlough days, and that's across the board, private and public universities. And I think what we don't realize is that the financial aid offices they're strained, but they make it look easy because their main job, and they've always had this commitment, as Mary said, we do have pearls in every single office. They make it look easy because they see those students every single day. In our office, we don't see students that often because we work through the financial aid offices. But they do everything they possibly can to get the students their money, to get it there to them quickly, and to scramble around and find extra money for the students. So I think that it's not a crisis, but one of the things that we do have to recognize is that as we put more and more on the financial aid offices with new programs, new regulations, more complexity from small foundations, you know, we do have to realize that they have to have the staff to do that. So those are the two biggest, well, they're not the only two, but we have many panelists here. But I just, you know, we're underfunded and they're being strained at every office across the state.
Next, we'll have Amy Kerwin from the Great Lakes.
I think I'll focus my remarks more on high schools and students before they apply for the FAFSA. I think one of our biggest concerns is that there's too many students who are not even filling out the FAFSA, so they're not getting to the point of determining how much aid they're eligible for. And we definitely see this on the side of the College Access Challenge Grant. We're focusing this year on approximately 270 low-income schools, and by low-income I mean those schools that are included on the teacher cancellation low-income directory published by the Department of Education. That's the source that we're using to determine whether or not a high school in Wisconsin is deemed to be low-income. One of the first things that we did for those schools is to determine whether or not a high school counselor existed at those schools. I think probably all of us know that Wisconsin has historically had one of the highest ratios of students to counselor, and we see that in our work every day. And there are a significant number of schools on our list that do not have a single guidance counselor, and there's also schools that share a guidance counselor, so there's one counselor to multiple schools. So definitely what we see is that these students, and again, they're low-income students, first-generation students, aren't having access to guidance on the importance of filling out the FAFSA, the importance of taking the right classes while they're in high school to be prepared to go to college. I think it's probably a different conversation, but one issue that we see is We go into a financial aid night and talk about eligibility for things like the ACG or the SMART grant, and inevitably we'll have a parent come up to one of our presenters after the fact and say, you know, if somebody would have told me when my child was a freshman that he or she needed to take these classes in order to be eligible for that aid, boy, wouldn't the world be a better place. So you telling me today that my child should have taken those classes 3 years is so not helpful for me. And I think each one of our college access advisors could share experiences that they've had in having that very difficult conversation. So I think the concern is just general awareness amongst the majority of the students and families that we're serving in some of those schools. And it's not, again, that the counselors aren't doing their job, it's that there aren't enough counselors and they don't have enough time to talk about preparing for college. I think that I see a lot of financial aid officers here, and I know that we're all very dedicated about going out and doing financial aid nights in our community, sharing the knowledge that you have about filling out the FAFSA, about going to college. But one financial aid night, we all know that. That's not enough to talk to all of the students and parents that we need to talk to. It's a recurring conversation that needs to happen, and students simply aren't aware of what they need to do to go to college, let alone how to complete the FAFSA. I know that later on today we'll have some conversations about how we can make the FAFSA easier to complete, but that's definitely what we're seeing. There's just a general lack of awareness of what steps do I need to take to get to college. How do I fill out the FAFSA? What is the difference between a grant and a loan? Where does a scholarship fit in? General lack of awareness. On the philanthropy side, when we're working with college or community-based organizations, we've seen over the last 12 months a marked shift in the amount of college-based programs that are being offered. So, for example, we've provided funding to a number of programs at Boys and Girls Clubs, for example. And those clubs are saying, we have to take the money that we're directing to college-bound programs and move those funds to other programs that meet more basic needs for the populations that we serve. So we're seeing, unfortunately, today a decline in the number of students and families served through college-based programs, and again, they're excellent opportunities for students who don't have a counselor at their local high school. They can go to a community-based organization and receive those services, and in this economy, with cutbacks, we're just seeing fewer and fewer of those programs being offered. We're incredibly happy to have the opportunity through the College Access Challenge Grant to actually put people on the street, to be having those one-on-one conversations. We've looked at what some other states are doing with their College Access Challenge Grant, and in a lot of states they're using the funds for things like software programs that are being made available in high schools, which is far, far different from having an actual person who can sit down and talk with a family in a presentation setting, as well as through setting up one-on-one hours for how do we talk, how do we complete the FAFSA, what are your goals. We have 10 college access advisors. 10 is clearly not enough to make a significant difference. The difference is significant to those students and families that we're able to touch, but fortunately through DPI, through a number of the other programs represented here today, we can make more of a difference. But in terms of awareness, I see that as our biggest challenge in Wisconsin today.
Great. Thank you, Amy. Kevin Ingram?
Is need-based financial aid reaching students? Yes. Is it reaching all students? No. And where's the gap at? The gap is we need more money. For example, in the White House Task Force on Middle Class Families, in that staff report, that's headed up by Vice President Biden and Secretary Duncan. In that report, we stress the importance of higher education in leading to higher earnings and greater economic mobility, and therefore its role as a determinant of one of the most important aspirations of families across America, if not the globe, the ability of our children to realize their full potential. We just need to make a better commitment to wanting to fund education. We need to make a better commitment in terms of A, working together collectively to try to push having more need-based grants, if not merit-based grants. For example, in my opinion, I think that if we were to focus on making sure that students had information regarding if you don't get money based on your need, the second round of money is in scholarships, if the goal is to try to reduce their loan debt. And I think, for the most part, the goal is to try to have them have as a small amount of loan as possible. But in many cases, that's not the case. And students turn away from loans because people scare them and thinking that, hey, if you get into taking a lot of loans, you won't be able to afford to pay it back. But if we think, or if we all agree, that going to college leads to greater economic mobility, then the question is, why aren't we putting that initial investment in and waiting for it to actually pay off? Because we've proven that it can pay off. And as a result of doing that, if we can come together and focus on that, for example, we've created a society whereby we create a competition, but we create a competition to weed people out, not to get people in. And as a result of it, when families feel like they can't afford to go to college, even though their sons or daughters are bright enough to go to a college and bright enough to choose a particular college they want to go to, even if it's a two-year college. Because what people fail to forget is that even when you go to a two-year college, you still have living expenses that are not necessarily factored in at a two-year school because you're living at home. But if that person was not living at home, particularly foster care children, you know, how could they afford to go to a two-year college if they didn't have enough A to go to the school? But more important than that, being able to have a residence, a place to stay, so they wouldn't necessarily have to worry about where am I going to stay if I do end up going to college. So a lot of kids end up choosing not going to college because they don't think they can afford it, when in reality, they can. The president has put over $200 billion into federal grants. Here in the state, when you add in the Wisconsin funds for scholars, and of $175 million, the $40 million from Great Lakes, plus now an additional $26 million from the governor, that's an additional $246 million in the state alone. The problem is, how come our kids are not getting this information? And according to this report, one of the barriers that are that's affecting our students is they're not getting this information. Despite the fact that we have college access, despite the fact that we have pre-college, despite the fact that we have the Wisconsin Covenant, and now the Challenge Access Grant. I think in Wisconsin, we're doing a good job, but I think that what we really need to create is a connection between our educational system in the sense that when you're in elementary school and you move on to middle school, we don't deal with those kids anymore. When they move from middle school to high school, middle schools don't deal with those kids anymore. We have a compartmentalized educational system versus a system whereby if we could, for example, what would really be nice, if we could take everything we're doing up on this table and put it into the schools and make sure that there's a continuum of information flowing so that when you run into a parent at a financial aid night or College Go Sunday night, i.e., they won't say, if I had known about that in ninth grade, I would have better prepared my child. And these are coming from parents who are middle-class parents. These are not necessarily parents who are poor. And when we think that because you're poor, you don't get this information, a lot of middle-class families are not getting this information. So from my perspective, in terms of looking at some of the research, I think the key would be if we can create a system. I know the state has passed a law for UW Systems and DPI to work on following kids from preschool all the way through college. If we can develop that kind of system, we might be able to put in place even more connections whereby we can get information not only to high school students, but start all that information right at the preschool level and walk it all the way up through the high school so that kids are more aware of all of their options in terms of financing their education, and not just think that if they take out a loan, that might be the end all, or that might be one of the things that discourages them from wanting to by the college.
Thank you, Kevin. And again, before Mary starts, I just want to repeat the question for those who are online if they just joined us. The question is need-based financial aid reaching all those who need it in Wisconsin? If not, where are the gaps? Mary Goldbrunson?
My first response is I don't know. I do know that 70,000 students, or roughly 70,000 students, graduate from high school each year in the state of Wisconsin. I know that many of them do not go to college. I know that only roughly 23% of our adult population in the state of Wisconsin has a college degree. So I know a few things. I know that the number of students that names that are submitted to HEAB for the Fund for Wisconsin Scholars Grant and our criteria are that they are full-time, that they graduated from a Wisconsin public high school within the last 3 years. They're under 21. They are full-time students at either a UW or a WTCS school, and they're a Pell recipient. We know that the names of those students that were submitted to HEAB numbered roughly 7,300 this year, and they had some need. So those were the criteria, and so we know those number, that number of students' names are submitted. But what we don't know, how many part-time students had that same need or greater need, how many students never went to college because they couldn't even think about paying for college, how many students are in the private and independent colleges that have that kind of need. We don't know a lot. And so my challenge would be to figure out where the gaps are. We really need to study. We need to do much more extensive research and examination of the students, K-12, and I would ditto everything that everyone said, so I'm trying to say something a little bit differently, that why is this journey not completed? Why do we not start at open house in kindergarten talking to parents about the journey that their students, their children are on, that it's not just graduation from high school, that it's a continuous journey for their lifetime? How do we even think about culturally what it means to get an advanced degree, to get some post-secondary education, to be a lifelong learner? We throw out a lot of terms, and having been in K-12 for years, I know we use a lot of those terms, but what does that really mean? So I guess my response to, is need-based financial aid reaching all those who need it in Wisconsin? Yes, no, and I don't know. If not, where are the gaps? And I think we need to study to really find out where the gaps are.
Great. Thank you for your honest answer. I appreciate that. The next respondent is Amy Beckham.
It's great being towards the end of the panel when you have already wonderful line of professionals already speaking on the topic, you get to say things like ditto. Like Mary saying, you know, there was already a number of really good points made, so kind of to add to the conversation, just answering a question I think has already been answered, is need-based financial aid reaching all that needed? Statistically speaking alone, you know, Connie already brought out numbers of those who are eligible, there are a great number who are not actually receiving the aid. So clearly the answer is no. I think another component to add to the discussion is defining need. You know, what is need? What is, you know, need-based aid? If all of us, you know, if all the students were reaching all the students we needed to, we probably wouldn't all be here today. So it's obvious that, you know, there are gaps. But in terms of defining need, that's where our challenge has been. The Wisconsin Covenant Scholars Grant is in the process of drafting administrative rules, which is meaning that it's, you know, trying to figure out what the grant will be, you know, the distribution, the criteria. Obviously, we want the money to be benefiting as many students as possible, but that's a real challenge in terms of defining, you know, what is need, who. What is that tipping point that's going to help a student and their family decide whether or not a student can go to college or not? So in defining, like I said, in defining need, to me, that's kind of one of those points of conversation. Who is the most needy? You know, who needs the money? I'm sure if you just went around a college campus, most students would say that they need money, you know. So that to me is kind of one of the things to add to this conversation. And like Mary mentioned, in terms of where are the gaps, again, I agree that, you know, more study, more research could be done in defining where are the gaps. Is it within the packages themselves? Is it the unmet need that's not being addressed? Or is it within, you know, demographic type of scenarios in terms of who we're reaching out to in terms of those student populations?
Great. Thank you. And last but not least, Molly Dillman.
A lot of really great things that were said, so I probably will echo a lot of them. The Lumina Foundation uses a big data point for them is that 90% of teens want to go to college, but 60% of those teens don't know how to go to college, and I would probably argue for low-income first-generation students, it's probably more than that. And so all the things that the panelists have already said about educating and empowering students and families to complete the FAFSA, I think, are really big things that we need to accomplish that we're starting to move forward with as a state. And as Amy had said, Amy Kerwin had said, with the recession and with budget cuts, oftentimes things like FAFSA nights and those sort of pre-college things sometimes get pushed to the back burner. So it's so critically important right now that we start collaborating, start bringing down those barriers between programs and initiatives so that we can efficiently and effectively start collaborating so that we're still meeting the needs of a community even though we may not have the resources that they need to do so. And I would also add, I think that possibly a gap in the state when we talk about need-based financial aid are non-traditional students and returning adults. As a state, we know that there are a lot of adults and returning adults that will be coming back to school, and they may not feel empowered or know what they need to do to fill out the FAFSA. So I think that may be a gap that we need to start addressing as a state.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for your candid and thoughtful responses. We'll turn to the next question, the second question, before we open it up to the audience. And the second question is, and Molly, you get prepared, you get to go first this time.
Okay.
And then, Connie, you can say ditto or Okay, so the second question is, what changes could be made within the next 5 years to increase the effectiveness of need-based financial aid in Wisconsin? So again, the question is, what changes could be made within the next 5 years to increase the effectiveness of need-based financial aid in Wisconsin? Molly? Gilman?
Aside from stating that we need more money, but as Kevin had said, even if we have an increased amount of money, students and families still aren't aware that the money's there. They don't realize that college is attainable. So that is something that I think we really need to continue to move forward with, making sure that students and families are empowered to be able to ask questions and fill out and complete the FAFSA. The simplification of the FAFSA that's starting to go into effect, I think, is a huge step forward for all of us. I saw a statistic the other day that 1.5 million students are Pell eligible in the nation but don't know it. So again, I think the simplification of the FAFSA is a good step forward. Something I think that we should consider doing as a state, Secretary Duncan, when he was the superintendent in Chicago, he worked within his city to be able to track students and their FAFSA completion, so that principals and teachers were aware of who was completing the FAFSA. This is why there are schools in Chicago that have 100% FAFSA completion rates. There are other things that we can do that we can tie FAFSA completion as incentives. There are schools in other states that if you don't complete the FAFSA, then you're not going to prom. I think we need to step up the importance of FAFSA and tie it to things that, you know, teens find important. And if it's prom, it's prom. And then again, I think we also need to think about working with our non-traditional students and returning adults, those who have started college but dropped out for whatever reason. If we're going to increase the number of graduates in our state, that's a huge population of people that we could be tapping into. and making sure that they understand the financial aid process, I think, is key to getting them involved.
Great. Thank you. Amy Beckham?
I agree with Molly in focus of, I think, education. Wisconsin is on a really good path where we have a number of programs in the state that is focusing on college education, preparation, College Extra Challenge Grant. The WEOP offices and their specialists have worked really hard to make sure that their students and families are very well informed about the process, how to fill out FAFSA form, how to take those steps in terms of making sure that they are fully aid eligible. Again, I kind of focus on, you know, taking a look at these students and trying to figure out, you know, if it is in fact increasing college access for these students, is more dollars instantly getting more students going to college, or is it the right dollars kind of the right place? And obviously that's kind of a tough question, but in terms of making the most use of minimal dollars given our current economy, we want to take a look at it for using it the best way. So, you know, in the next 5 years, I think the state initiatives that are going on, NOAACA, Wisconsin College Access, Wisconsin Covenant, and the current pre-college programs are all going to continue to work very closely together to make sure that we are, in fact, educating as many students and families on the process of going to college and preparing for college, including the financial aid process. But I think our responsibility and our challenge too would be to see, you know, are we making a good impact in terms of the number of students going? Are there other barriers, other factors in addition to just cost?
Thank you, Amy. Mary Gulbranson?
I probably won't be as brief with this response because I do have lots of opinions about it. My simple answer, and it's the same one I gave to the last question, and that, you know, what changes could be made, I don't honestly know, but I have a lot of opinions about what might be. I think that the research and study needs to continue. I know that Sarah Goddard-Grab and Doug Harris are doing an extensive study, and that's very, very important because I think there are lots of unanswered questions. Obviously, some changes that can be made. The FAFSA, that's a pretty obvious one. And it's interesting to me that there is a great deal of support in many of our high schools and to both families and students to fill out that FAFSA, to get it in. But that FAFSA has to be filled out every single year. And once that student is on their own, and I've had three that have become on their own, and they aren't always the most reliable. So how do we support the student once they're in post-secondary education to continue that journey, know how to fill that out, take the initiative to get it filled out, and continue that that process and get their information in? I think we need to know. One of the points that Amy made is how much need is there, and where is that need cut off? I think about the FAFSA, who is Pell eligible, but what about that next layer of families that are at the $50,000 income and have two students going to college? What kinds of resources do they need, or what kinds of resources does a student need? How much work is reasonable for a student to do while they're in college? What is the magic number of support that they need? What are the cultural issues about loans versus no loans, grants versus scholarships? How do we understand all of what happens when a student is making a decision about the kinds of financial aid that they, he or she will or will not take to continue their education? I talked a little bit about the journey for parents, understanding that education is a lifelong journey. When I talk about 23% of our state of Wisconsin with a college degree, what is the emphasis, and do families understand the importance? And, you know, certainly members of our family, some are educated, some have technical degrees, some have college degrees, and some have further degrees. All of them have an important role in our society. So how do we get the right matches? How do they know what the right post-secondary opportunity is, and then how do they pay for it? So I think that there are some issues that we need to explore much deeper with our children and our families as they sort through what's important. We clearly know that the economy of the state, of any state, does better when you have a more educated population. So that is driving a lot of why we are talking about this. But again, I think we need to match. So as I talk about further research and study, that doesn't mean I think we should stop our efforts right now. I do think that we need to work together at all ranges of age, whether it's K-12, whether it's the students that are in college, whether it's adults returning to college, and what parents and our citizens have to say about supporting education way beyond K-12. You know, I think about all of us sitting here and how often we come together to talk about what's important. And that doesn't happen very frequently. We have conversations, two or three of us, about how we might work together. But is there a way that we can network much more collaboratively and much in a much stronger manner that we get a message out to our families? But I would also say that as we as a state, whether it's a private foundation, whether it's the legislature, whether it's the governor, whether it's an individual college or a system, we have experts in the field. The financial aid officers in this state know so much about this topic, and I think that we need to approach them in a much more rigorous and diligent manner to hear what they have to say. What have they learned? What can they tell us about what is important for students to stay in college and to finish their degrees? Again, I guess I would end it by saying, you know, I could, it's a soapbox, and I would go on for a long, long time. But I do think we need to study. I think we need to work together. I don't think we can be in silos. But I don't think any of us stop what we're doing right now as we do those things. And I think we can make this an even greater state by continuing those partnerships.
Great. Thank you, Mary. Kevin Ingram?
I want to end with a personal story, but I want to start off by saying I wish we could, or maybe we can, go back to a time when we financed education and 80% of it was in the form of grants, merit scholarships, and 20% of it was in the form of loans, meaning that as you get older and matriculate your way through college towards your junior and senior year, you would be reduced on the grant side. Keep your merit scholarships and then take on more loans because now you have an invested interest in actually finishing versus somebody paying the whole entire bill and you taking your education for granted for those students who don't have the opportunity to get a Bill and Melinda Gates scholarship. Because even though those scholarships exist, there are a lot of other students who also have 3-point cumulative grade point averages, but yet they don't have the ability to get the scholarship because the money ran out, as in case of like Wegg and TG. I think that it would be nice, it's my utopian idea, we can end the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Take that money that we were spending and turn it around and put it into education. Because if you talk to teachers and if you talk to principals, what you will hear is, although we may say we want to value education, and although we know it pays off, we just have, as the medical college says, they practice what they teach. We're not practicing what we're advocating or teaching. And we're not putting money behind our words to demonstrate that. We've proven that we can sustain a war. We've proven that we can go the long haul. But we haven't necessarily proven that we're willing to go the long haul when it comes to education. For example, in their October 19th report, U.S. News and World Report did a report on the following article. Who really gets the most college financial aid? New studies find earnings less A new study finds families earning less than $70,000 on average don't get enough financial aid. And in this article, they kind of went through families making $35,000, $65,000. They kind of assessed how much that family could afford. For example, this one family, they make $170,000 a year. They can afford to pay estimated $36,000. When you fill out the financial aid form, you get your family contribution back, and it tells you what the family's expected contribution towards their college education. It doesn't say that this is the requirement, that the family is required to come up with this money, because they may not, because of money and tax shelters or whatever the case may be. But if they can afford to pay $36,000, then they can afford any UW system school. They can afford a private school in the state of Wisconsin. And yet, many of these families are getting merit aid. They don't necessarily need it, but they're getting it. So follow me for a second. In the Pell Institute research on moving beyond college access for low-income first-generation students, it stated that without including loans, there's about a $27 billion gap remaining in need base for the population of low-income first-generation students. However, by contrast, their most advanced peers receive approximately $28 billion more than they need without even including the amount they receive in loans. It would be nice if we could reverse that, but I can't sit here and make the argument because as a child growing up, I didn't have a clue what college was about. I didn't have a clue where to go. All I knew was that I was sitting at home watching the Marquette basketball team 1977 win a championship team. Championship. All I remember is Butch Lee coming to Columbia Playground on 14th and Chambers and all being excited that here is an athlete and I want to go to college. All I know is that I had a guidance counselor that says, you have good grades, yeah, so-so test scores, but here's where you need to go to school. The point I'm trying to make here is this. If we work together to make sure that irregardless, we know that everybody, first of all, is not going to college. We know that. We know our society is set up for, if you do this, we want to pigeonhole to take you here. The problem is we don't have factories to absorb our kids. So people can't drop out of school no more and get a job. Now that they're dropping out, they have no place to go. And we don't have nothing for them. Because if we had some place for them to go, we would not be concerned about kids dropping out of school because they can go and get a job and still make enough money to raise a family, have a decent lifestyle, better than and almost equal to that of a student who graduated and went to college. We don't have that, so we're pushing college. But the point is, what we need to do at our K-12 system is make sure that, because if I grew up without a mother and I'm just living with my grandmother who has no knowledge, is clueless, yet I graduate from high school ready to either work full-time or go to college. Those are my two choices. I went to college. Or I could have became the manager of McDonald's and owned me a bunch of franchises. But I came out prepared, and the key is if we can have focusing on getting these kids to come out prepared so that they choose whether or not they want to go to college or not. Because I can't sit here and argue and say, hey, yeah, you make $170,000, but look, you have good grades and good test scores too. I'm sure your parents wouldn't want to if they didn't have to pay for your college education because you earned it. That's more money for them to put aside for something else. So I can't argue that we take the money from them and give it to me. The point is, if I come out equally prepared at $10,000 a year on family income, and you coming out at $170,000 a year, then both of us should be able to go to college. Both of us should be able to, based on our grades and test scores, compete for grants and scholarships. And if need be, hopefully, in your case, you can afford to take out a loan. Not take out a loan, but your parents can write a check for the balance. I may have to take out a loan, but the point is, if we can make that more affordable for those who are $70,000 and less, such that you don't even feel the impact, whether or not, you don't know the difference between whether I'm here on this college campus as a $170,000 person from a family or a $10,000 person from a family. I'm here because there's a system in place that's supporting me and helping me get my education. So for me, over the next 5 years, I would love for us to end the war and then take that money and stick it back in education.
Thank you, Kevin.
That's my soapbox.
Thank you. Amy Curran?
And it'll be obvious now that my account or my background is in accounting. So my question is, you know, how do you define effective? So, but then also as somebody who's now subjected to audits, I know better than to ask that question and instead answer the way I want to answer that. So, I'll look at it. I think is effectiveness based on access or is it based on persistence? So if it's based on access, I think that there's a number of things we can do. The Wisconsin Covenant Foundation is doing some research right now to determine whether an early award for a low-income first-generation student makes a difference. So does telling a high school student when they're a freshman, when they're a sophomore, that there is money, this amount of money, waiting for you when you graduate from high school and go to college, does that make a difference? Does it make it more likely for that student to matriculate? That would be one way to measure effectiveness. I think on the other side, I think we have to look at what is the definition of effective? Is the definition of effective that a student who receives need-based aid completes their degree and leaves the institution that they attended with a degree that they enrolled, now they're able to get another job? I do recognize that there are lots of studies that show that students who have some college earn more than students who have no college, but is a student who receives need-based financial aid and then drops out before they complete their degree, do we think that that's effective? Is that an effective use of need-based financial aid? I can tell you that at Great Lakes, we also helped students repay their student loans, and the portfolio of defaulted borrowers who obtained federal student loans and then defaulted, 80% of the students who defaulted on their loans are students who did not complete their degree of study. Is that an effective use of need-based financial aid? Granted, it's not all need-based. Some of it is unsubsidized Stafford loans. But I think it would behoove us to do some additional research going to what Mary has talked about. Why are these students who are receiving need-based financial aid not completing their program of study? Is it because they weren't prepared to go to college academically? Is it because they didn't have the budgeting, the financial skills necessary now that they're on their own to manage their resources in an effective way? I don't know. I don't know, but I do know that I think it's incredibly disheartening to know that there are 80% of the defaulted borrowers in our portfolio have the debt, but don't have the degree that they need to obtain the income to repay that debt. It is an incredible disadvantage for those students to go back to school. And also, I just from the hurdle, I failed the first time and I have this mountain of debt. Do I really want to give that another try to complete my degree? I think the answer for many people is no.
Great. Thank you, Amy. Connie?
That's an interesting perspective, and I agree with it to a point, but I also think one of the things that I have listed on my list of things that I think we need to make sure we do, that I was going to talk about later, was we can't give up on students who drop out for some reason or another. I think all of us know somebody who, and I'm working with someone now, who received financial aid and went to school, and smart, bright, really should be able to get a degree. But family pressures at home, a single parent, younger brother needing him at home, and just feeling so overwhelmed that now he was at school taking care of himself and was still hearing from his brother that he needed help at home, and he dropped out. And, you know, the whole thing is, you know, we have to work with those kids to help them find ways to manage their family situations and also them to get back into school, because they do, as Kevin said, you know, they have the ability, but not always the financial resources behind them. But
But I do agree that we do have to look more closely at financial aid and see where our successes are and where the problems are, because you can't really change fix a problem unless you can identify that there's a problem there. So several people have already mentioned that we need to continue doing more research and look at what's going on in order to identify some of the problems. I think that the coordination of the pre-college programs is really essential, and I know that Molly spoke about the College Access Network. I know the Wisconsin Association of Student Financial Aid Administrators is looking at ways that they can help assist with the coordination of the pre-college programs. I think we've just had so many programs start recently, and I think it's not because they're disjointed or they have different views. It's just so many people at the same time thought, we need to get this done. Things get started, the governor and Mrs. Doyle with their program with the Covenant, and now it's at that point where they need to start coordinating, and a lot of people are talking about that too, to make them more effective. The other thing I think we need to do with the pre-college programs, and someone mentioned starting at kindergarten, but I think we need to start talking to people more about the need to save for college, whether you believe that that's going to be your path or not. I don't think that a lot of people realize that programs, the 529 college savings programs such as EdVest that we have in this state, you can do that for $15 a month if you do automatic payroll deduction. I really believe that we should be talking to families, and I love Chancellor Martin calling these families of modest means, not the needy and the poor, but families of modest means, some people who have, they make enough to start saving for their kids when their kids are younger. I think it's really critical that we get in, that we talk to families and parents about that when they are much younger. And because if they're saving for college, they're also starting to think about preparing for college at a much younger age. And I think that's critical. And in doing that, another way to do that would be to start being more proactive with the local education and community foundations that we have. Kevin mentioned a lot of merit aid, and I was at a scholarship night in our community, and we have a small foundation, education, it's actually pretty big for the size of our community in McFarland. But, you know, so much of that aid does go to students whose families can help them already in school. And there have to be ways to deal with and work with the education and community foundations, the smaller ones that are around the state that many, many communities have, to help them find, to help talk about ways that we can be more innovative about getting scholarships to kids of modest, who come from families of modest means. For example, maybe when, you know, if there's a student who is part of the Covenant and their family has committed to putting dollars into an EdVest account through high school, maybe some of those local community and education foundations could start matching that and working and being proactive rather than getting out after the students are done and they're saying, I didn't know I had to take that. So there are a lot of ways I think that we could be innovative with those education and community foundations. I think that it's really, really important for those of us who are in positions where we talk to legislators and governors and other officials who have the ability to put money into financial aid, that we have to find different ways to talk about financial aid. You know, there are some people, and we're fortunate in Wisconsin that we have support for financial aid in both the Republican and the Democratic Party, and that's how we've been able to increase aid over the years. But we do have people that view financial aid as a handout. And I think that we have to find ways to talk about aid, and I think research on how effective financial aid can be, it would be critical in this. But I believe that we need to find ways to talk about financial aid not as a handout, but as an investment in the future of the state. That so many of the things that Kevin said about, you have families with this income and this income, and the kids are of the same abilities, and yet it's such a struggle for kids without means to get through college. And making sure that we can see that investment and have people who've made it through college help us talk about those issues, the personal stories of students who've received aid and have made it through and now are, you know, in jobs that are supporting them and also supporting our state. I think that's really important. And then finally, and I should have mentioned this when I was talking about the pre-college programs, you know, not only having students fill out the FAFSA, but I know that there are states where all students in high school take the ACT and the SAT. Mm-hmm. It's a requirement. There are some kids who, it's the idea of taking that and the amount of money that they have to pay to take the ACT just is, it's overwhelming. And the idea of getting there and taking the test and thinking about it ahead of time, if that was part of the high school preparation, I think that that would help, as well as having those initiatives in high schools where the students are there and their families and they fill out the FAFSA so that every student has that done. So those are some of the things that I think we need to do. And also, we do have some successful programs now where I'm kind of jumping around here, but in talking about financial aid and the effectiveness of it, I know that there are some initiatives already. Chancellor Martin spoke about the Madison, the UW-Madison initiative, where they're finding ways to talk about aid and try and get more aid to students. UW-Oshkosh, Chancellor Wells has spearheaded a campus-based work-study program in addition to the federal work-study program, where when we talked about it, the whole discussion of, you know, getting community to support financial aid when, and everybody who's been in education and financial aid knows that work study and the amount of work study that a student does, some hours of working during college, really do help students to succeed at getting a degree in college. So some of those kinds of programs, and then also looking to the private and independent colleges and universities who've had very successful campus-based initiatives to get financial aid to students for years and years and years out of necessity and out of innovation. So looking to the places that already are starting to do this or have been doing this for many, many years, I think that's critical as a component so that we are all working together. We're bringing together a message that's a little bit more proactive rather than reactive. And just doing as much as we can from the very beginning of school till the students have completed their degrees at the high schools or at the colleges and universities around the state. And the war.
Excellent. Thank you very much for helping us get started this morning. This is very beneficial. What we'll next do is we'll take questions from the audience, and now it's time for you to get engaged to help the panelists. And I'll look to see if there are any. First, Ed, do you have the mic? Okay. And there we go. We'll start with Rebecca, and then we'll see if there's any questions from the online audience. Rebecca Martin.
I first of all want to thank all of you for your comments and say ditto, ditto, ditto. I mean, these are all issues that we're grappling with. And I'm particularly interested in research and thinking about what we know about the many, many students. And Connie, how many was it that didn't get the WEG this year?
It's going to be close to 28,000.
Thousands, thousands of
yes.
students. Having served on a campus in the UW system that is the most diverse campus in the system, I know that many students of color, many students from first-generation families do not make the decision to apply to college till very late in the game because they're struggling with trying to figure out all the things that you've talked about. Am I prepared? How do I put this together? And therefore, those are the students, maybe some of our most needy students, who didn't get aid this year. So I'm wondering what we know about those 28,000 students, how we might think about, you know, what's going to happen if the money runs out again next year, because I'm unfortunately not sanguine about the thinking that there's going to be a whole lot of money to close the gap, and is there a way that we should be thinking differently about that distribution? And I'd be really interested in any of your comments on that.
Great. Thank you.
I can answer a little bit. We do have a task force that the board of the Higher Educational Aids Board put together, a task force that includes financial aid directors and from around the state. And that is one of the things that we'll be looking at because I think that although we do know that students who or we've heard that students of lesser means apply later. There also has to be an understanding that the students who are getting aid are very, and I'm not going to say of modest means, they're poor. So I just think that we need to be careful of making it sound like the students who got the Wisconsin Higher Education Grant, the tuition grant this year, are quite a bit wealthier than the students who didn't, because I think the maximum EFC is still under $5,000 for any student who's applied. And we know that more than 50% of the students who've gotten aid that were eligible and were not on the wait list are zero EFC, so they are the poorest of the poor. But we do want to take a look at that, because if it does look like there's that students who are on the wait list do have a much higher need than students who got aid, then there are some things that we can do immediately, such as lower the maximum EFC and cut out students of, you know, higher means. And also, that's in the short term, and then in the long term, look at different, well, there's only so, I mean, you have a pie, there's so many, you can give it to 40 people or you can give it to four, but it's still a pie. So I think that, but again, having that information about the specific students who are eligible but will not receive aid is just more specific data and information that helps us in the future to get people to understand the real need that's out there. So that was a long way of saying I don't really know what we're going to do, but we're going to study it.
Any other panelists want to respond? Okay. No? Bo, is there a question from the online audience?
All right, so as Noel said, this question comes to us from the online discussion that we're running right now. Now, we know that the actual costs of attending college are often a lot higher than the sticker price that's given out by the university. Should financial aid also consider living expenses beyond those that are expressly articulated by the college?
Well, and I'm the least probably knowledgeable about this, but my understanding from the financial aid officers is when they look at cost of attendance, the living cost, the living expenses are included in that cost of attendance that each school puts into their formula when they're trying to determine what the cost of attendance at any one school happens to be. I think that there's, you know, some wavering, and especially if a student is living at home, does their cost of attendance then look different than another student? And so it gets a little more complicated. But my understanding is cost of attendance can take into consideration everything from child care to living expenses within some boundaries. I don't think it's just, you know, it's not loose by any means, but that can be included. You know, and one thing I think about when I listen to all of the questions and each one of us speaking is that we're all concerned about whether students are academically prepared to go to school. We're concerned about whether they have the financial means. And I often wonder, and Biddy kind of struck me this morning when she talked about imagination, do I see myself on a campus? How do I know how to be on a campus? How do I do college? Do I have the right jeans to wear? And I know that sounds silly, but, you know, I mean, especially for some families, they have no picture of what that looks like. So how do we take care of all three of those pieces? Because financial aid will only be useful if we have the other two pieces there as well. So cost of attendance has to include all of that.
Although it's not part of the question from the online audience member, I just want to add to Mary's point. When we go out and do financial aid nights, it's like doing a financial literacy presentation. The people who tend to come to the event are those people who are going to find their way to college somehow. They've got questions, but they've already made the leap that this is something that I'm interested in and want to learn more about. I think our biggest question is how do we reach those students and families who don't come to the college aid night or financial aid night, who don't come to a College Goal Sunday event. Those are the students and families where college isn't yet on the radar because they haven't imagined it or because they've determined that I'm not even going to ask questions because I know that my family can't afford to send me to college.
I would like to add to that because I think that there are definitely a large group population of people out there who don't see themselves going to college or would like to go to college but don't feel like their family has the means to go there. But I think that there's a huge population out there who actually don't see a value in going to college. I think that that's something as a state that we're starting to work towards is creating that college-going culture. You see it in the urban areas, but you see it in the rural areas especially, where you have parents who have been working in factories, I think somebody had mentioned, and the child may have the means to go to college and is in a college city, but doesn't see the value in going to college. I think that that's something that we need to continue to address.
Okay. Any other more questions from the audience? Okay. Jay, and then...
there's been an awful lot of money spent over the years in trying to get the word out about student aid down in grade school, you know, the availability of the aid, the rewards for going to college. And I've always had the sense that one of the reasons that didn't work was because, you know, there was no good news from it. That for example, the Pell Grant initial dropout rate is very high, you know, so... you get a grant, you get in, but you won't succeed. And so there's bad news back in the community, and that's maybe why people aren't picking up and availing themselves of all the opportunities. But one area I've been wondering about, and the researchers are seeing that there's too much dependence on loans. So we've gone over the top on loans. Is anybody talking about expanding loan forgiveness? I've looked at some of the European programs that have pretty extensive loan forgiveness programs, and so the one of the ones in Scandinavia is if you go to college 1 year and drop out, and you borrow money, you have to pay the full loan. If you get through the third year, you know, you get a 20% grant for what you borrowed. If you make it to graduation, you get 40% off. If you're in grad school, you get 75% off. So there's a reward. I mean, there's at the end of the tunnel, you know, if you persist and get this degree, you know, you will be rewarded. The cost will come down. I don't know. We haven't talked about that very much. We have. For certain occupations, we have loan forgiveness, but I wonder if, because of the spiking of debt, you know, if this wouldn't be a good time to start talking about loan forgiveness. And I have a question of fact that I don't know if you need to answer it right now, but at the federal level, you have all this move to direct lending. How is that being financed? Is that financed by payback from borrowing, or is that directly out of the federal budget? I don't know the answer to that question, but I think if the answer is it's circulating money, that would be a source of funding for something like loan forgiveness.
Who wants to tackle that question first? Connie?
I'll talk about loan forgiveness first because, this is great. It's been all these years, and I still learn something from Professor Stampin sitting here on a panel. I'm not a big fan of loan forgiveness programs because they're very difficult to administer over time. But I do think that the model that you put forth is a little bit different because it doesn't depend immediately on a student graduating and then they work for a year and they get 25% forgiven and then 30 and then 4, and which is typically how those loans work out. And I think the idea of looking at a loan that is forgiven not by you getting a job but by you staying in school, that seems to be a more workable model and something that I think would be much easier to track. I think it's worth looking into, and the next time I talk to Secretary Duncan. No, I'm kidding. but I do believe that, you know, again, looking at not just what my experience has been in loans, but what are other models out there? I know that we have distinguished visitors from the state of Washington that will be speaking this afternoon. Maybe they have loan forgiveness programs they can talk about, too. But I like that model, and I do think it's something to that would be more workable and probably more of an incentive for students to stay in school. And I have absolutely no idea about going to direct lending.
On the forgiveness side, I think your point about bad news is very, very well taken. There's a teacher loan forgiveness program that provides up to $17,500 in loan forgiveness for federal loans, but there are the rejection rate or the rate for those applications is very, very high because it there's a lot of eligibility requirements. So the teacher has to have received their first loan on or after October 1st, 1998, and they had to have taught for at least 5 years in a low-income school. And so I think a lot of people hear, well, I applied for that and I was rejected. I was rejected. So we hear that a lot. And then for a number of the other federal loan forgiveness programs, they're only available if you received your loan through the federal direct loan program as opposed to the federal family education loan program. And I think that that's confusing for your average student loan borrower. It's confusing for me, and I work in the industry. So I think that that is definitely a challenge. I think that loan forgiveness programs can be a good thing, but I think they're very, very difficult to administer. And I don't know if the financial aid officers in the arena want to talk about the TEACH grant and administering that.
Other comments from the panelists?
I just wanted to add, not, I don't know if you could address your question directly, but in an indirect way. I feel fortunate to be sitting up here only because he happens at the table, Great Lakes is at the table, and as I said, towards the end of my college career, I had a loan from Great Lakes. And so I was able to, when I graduated, and this is, you know, in terms of reducing, when I graduated with a loan balance that I could afford to pay back with a salary of my first job, $17,000 a year. That was my starting salary after coming out of college for 4 years, with a loan debt of $9,000. So when somebody looks at me and say, because I'm not working at IBM and making a huge lot of money, I'm working in education, and I'll never make enough money to do blah, blah, blah. Well, I made enough money in education to pay back my loans, only because I had a small amount coming out. So if we could do something like that whereby they start out with a large loan or they start out with a large grant, but towards the end, somehow or another, for those students who don't have the fortunate opportunity to receive a full academic scholarship, because even when they receive a full academic scholarship, the requirements are they must maintain a certain grade point average to keep the scholarship. And if they don't keep the grade point average up, they end up losing the scholarship and eventually have to turn around and take out loans if they want to stay in school. But the point is, if we can get to a point where we can get students who may not have the opportunity to get a full package that's based on scholarships and grants, yet be able to help them manage their finances such that you take an interest in this versus somebody paying for it completely for you. And if we can if the balance can be such that, hey, I know I have a responsibility because I see a college education similar to a car loan. These kids are going to get a car. And they're going to pay the month, they're going to pay the note, hook or crook, they're going to find a job to help them do that. So I kind of see our college education likewise as a car loan. We're going to find us a job that's going to help us pay that car loan, and we have to invest a portion of that money in it because no one, we go to the bank, but again, that bank is invested in us because we have the ability to pay that bank back.
Margaret Lewis and then Sarah Goldberg-Rapp.
Well, I may not have been following this real closely, but when I was hearing that there were 28,000 students eligible for WEG grants, but there was lacking funding for that. And then I heard all of the additional financial aid that was available from Great Lakes and covenants and other things. It just, you know, appears to me that why isn't that money all being pooled and getting to the most needy students? And so something I'm missing, and so I'm hoping somebody can explain that to me. If there's that much aid available, why isn't it being all focused on the most needy students, which I would think would be in the WEG program?
The money that was talked about for the Covenant and for the Covenant Foundation really hasn't started reaching the students yet. And that's one of the reasons the Great Lakes Higher Education, Amy and I just talked this morning about making sure we coordinate before they start giving out grants. And I know that Amy has a meeting with us and several other people this week to talk about the rules for the actual Covenant grants. So there is a lot of coordination going on. It sounds like the money is there now, but really it's not, and it won't really start until a year from next fall that the grants will be getting out there. But they are planning on coordinating with us, and so I think that we're going to be trying to do exactly what you said, Margaret. Does that make sense? And I also want to clarify that it's the number of students who are not eligible, so the Wisconsin Higher Education Grant and the tuition grant, which are basically the same kind of loan, except the tuition grant is basically the state Pell Grant for kids in private and independent colleges. But we are going to be working very closely together to make sure that we're not duplicating efforts or, you know. But that's a good point.
I just would add that the Fund for Wisconsin Scholars is a private foundation, and it's an endowment, so we want this to go on for eternity, whatever eternity is. The students that receive a Fund for Wisconsin Scholars grant, it is in addition to a Pell Grant or a WEG. These students still have unmet need, and our goal is to reduce the financial impact of college and to lighten the debt. So the students that receive a Fund for Wisconsin Scholars grant, which is only 900 additional students each year, ultimately we'll be giving about 3,000 students grants every year. But as I said earlier, we're only in our second year. Those students still have unmet need after receiving all of that money. So that there's a lot of need out there. It's not like we can fill it up just by putting all of these buckets together at one time. And I think the other thing that we are very much trying to do in collaboration with the researchers is to understand what is that line at which a student will continue and complete college. How much money do they need? And our grants are to, again, reduce the amount of work study and to reduce the loans that students take out so that the debt is lightened when they graduate from college. So if we could take... We give out about $5.5 million a year. If we took that across everyone, we could give everybody maybe $100. And will we know what the impact of $100 is to a lot of kids, or is it better to give a significant amount of money to fewer kids, painful as that is, so that we can understand what that impact might be? It's really hard to affect policy if we don't know what the impact ultimately is.
Right. I think okay. Going back to my effectiveness comment earlier, gee, wouldn't it be nice if instead of the federal government spending so much resources on collecting defaulted loans, that instead that money went into student services programs while those students were in college and helping them overcome the challenges that could cause them to drop out. So just shifting those resources, helping them stay in college, helping them get their degree.
Okay. Speaking of researchers, Professor Sarah Goldberg-Grabb.
I think this will piggyback actually very nicely on both what Mary just said and what Amy said as well. I wanted to give you all an opportunity to take a step back from some of these specifics and speak a little bit more about bigger picture issues. In particular, I'm intrigued by some of the differences in how you're talking about the goal and the problem. And I'm wondering whether, from your perspective of your program, or if you're not running a specific program, more generally, do you think the problem is that need-based aid is insufficient right now to adequately support students in their quest to get a degree, if that's their goal? Or is it inadequate to provide an incentive for them to complete a degree, in other words, to motivate them? Because I'm hearing different kinds of language used around what we're trying to do with the money. And I think that there's been a shift over time across history in what we're trying to do with the money, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are. So in other words, what if you're using the aid to achieve something with regard to students, what is it really that you're trying to do?
Interesting question.
When I talk to students, my focus is this. And the reason why I said earlier, if we could start this process from kindergarten all the way through. An example I like to use is I had a student who had a choice between Duke University and Florida A&M. I don't want to stay in Wisconsin. Okay, fine. But you have to apply to a school in Wisconsin, only because if, for whatever reason, you don't get enough money to go out of state, Wisconsin does have a pretty good level of grants that can help you afford to stay here in school. He had a choice to go to Florida, Duke. Duke tuition was $38,000. Duke was giving him in grants and loans up to $28,000. He still was $10,000 short. Florida A&M was giving him a full ride, plus an internship, plus a job anywhere in the country. During his sophomore year, I mean, he couldn't pick. They told him where he had to go. That was part of his stipend. And so the question was, well, what should I do? I said, you have to make up your mind and determine where you want to go. My goal was to convince you that if you stayed in the Upper Bound program, if you did the things we asked you to do, I've always told kids that, hey, you shouldn't worry about where the money's coming from. So I'm looking at it as a motivational point of view, that you shouldn't worry about where the money's coming from, because it's going to come because you have the grades and the test scores to go anywhere you want to go. The key is convincing you to do what I'm asking you to do such that you can realize what I'm telling you is the truth. And as a result of it, you now have a choice between two very top schools. And if you predominantly white school or predominantly black school, it's your choice to decide what you really want to do. And so therefore, I think that in my opinion, I think that it's the need-based grant is not necessarily, it's a good motivator, but not necessarily adequate enough to sustain them through. And that's why I would argue for, if we can load up on the front end with the intent that this is only going to be for 2 years. 2 years later, you will have to take out a loan, because we've gotten you to this point. And therefore, if you take the next step and accept the investment and take out, and if you had to go that route and take out a loan, it means that you would have less debt coming out of college in such a way that, A, you can do what we've asked people to do, go to college to get a adequate job that would allow you not only to pay back your loan, but allow you to afford a house, afford a car, and do all those other things. Because in the end, all we're really doing is telling people to go to college to get a job so that they can pay for the things they want to pay for. You know, so I look at it more so as a motivator.
Connie?
I think that's a really good question, and it for me it goes back to what I said earlier about I think we have to find a different way to talk about financial aid in order to secure more funds. And I hadn't thought about it so clearly, Sarah, the way you said it, is that it really doesn't seem to me, and this is just me from my own point of view talking about myself, that there is a real clear message about what financial aid is for, why we need it, and why it would be effective, whether it's to get kids to college or keep them in college or both. So I do think that those are the kind of things that we need to start looking at together, the private and independent colleges, WACU, with WTCS, with UW System Administration, just from that level of making sure that we're all on the same page and using the same message so that we're clear about why we need more financial aid. I really like that question a lot, but I really couldn't answer it myself right now. So thank you.
For the Punta Wisconsin Scholars, there is no question. Our intent is college completion. And so we do believe it's a retention grant, and that's why students are eligible for it for up to 10 semesters. However, within that, if you read our materials, you'll see that our belief system has many components to it. One is, of course, for the economy of the state of Wisconsin. We understand that more college degrees help the state have a better economy. But we also know that college-educated people are healthier. So it impacts the health of individuals. We do believe that when students come together on a campus, that there is interaction around learning about one another's culture, about how one thinks about ideas, that bringing people together at the point in their lives when they're 18 to 24 and older, and I'm not excluding older learners, but you think developmentally about where people are at that point in their lives. The sharing of ideas will only make our world a better place. So we have many beliefs about why we want students to stay in college, but our primary is college completion. So for us, that's very clear. And so we will focus on the 10 semesters.
I think for the Wisconsin Covenant Foundation, the goal is motivation, especially if we're announcing an early award to students while they're juniors, that this is the amount of money that is waiting for you. That's to motivate those students to go to college. But I think that the more traditional student loans are for support, so that the second half. So these are students who have said, I want to go to UW-Madison. I've got my own motivation. I know where I want to go. I just can't afford it. I can't go unless I receive those student loans. So I think the answer is yes to both, and it depends on the audience that we're trying to reach.
For Know How to Go, we use financial aid as a part of the motivation to get kids to go to college. We discuss it along with being academically prepared and socially prepared, so it's just one facet of motivation to get kids to. Without one, you know, the likelihood that you're going to be successful is higher.
I'm getting the signal that it's time, unfortunately. I know there are several other questions, but we do have questions built in throughout the remainder of the day. As well, we have a break now until 10:45. So, first of all, I want to thank all the panelists for the conversation. And second, I want to thank you. And let's take a small break, and we'll begin at 10:45. Thank you very much.